This is Scott Becker with the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. Thrilled today to be joined by Dr. Hudson Garrett, who's going to talk to us about COVID-19 and some of his thoughts and some of his perspectives. Dr. Garrett, can you take a moment and introduce yourself?
Sure. Well, good morning. Thanks for the invitation to join today. My name is Hudson Garrett. I'm based out of Atlanta, Georgia, and I actually am the president and chief executive officer for Community Health Associates, which is a private consulting firm. Really focused on healthcare-associated infections and infection prevention. And I also serve as an adjunct assistant professor of medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases at the University of Louisville School of Medicine as well.
Well, fantastic. Thank you for joining us. What is the current status of the COVID-19 outbreak, both globally and in the U.S.? Your perspective on what's the current status?
Sure. Well, as of this morning, we're, you know, almost at 500,000 cases globally. And the last stats that I saw for the U.S. was we were close to 70,000 cases. And interestingly enough, we're now seeing, you know, cases in all 50 states, as well as all of the U.S. Jurisdictions as well, with widespread community sort of outbreaks right now in 47 states.
If we're already at 500,000 or nationally 70,000 here, does that mean the real number is 2, 3, 4 times that, just because there's not, you know, truly as much testing as you'd want to really know how many people have it? What's your sense of that?
I think that's a pretty fair assessment. I mean, anytime we launch a community-based test, especially now with private diagnostics, we're going to see a pretty marked spike in the number of cases being reported as positive. That being said, what's interesting about this particular outbreak and pandemic is that the actual surveillance test is not actually guiding treatment. So, you know, it's not something that you have to have in order to treat a patient, but it really helps us from a public health perspective sort of understand the true granularity of how many cases might be out there. But really, more importantly, from a public health perspective, we're looking to stop community spread and transmission and also keep our healthcare providers safe, which is probably one of the most concerning things regarding this current pandemic, is that we've seen a lot of healthcare transmission to healthcare workers that have been exposed.
And that is truly one of the scariest things, if both because those are very brave souls, because their immune systems are getting battered with this, and then the concern losing them and the amount of heroes created, just a horrible situation. Which turn to the next question: is the federal government taking the appropriate actions to curb the pandemic? Your thoughts on that?
You know, I think anytime we have a situation of this mass proportion, there's always going to be opportunities for improvement. The one thing that I think could have been, you know, strengthened pretty rapidly from the very beginning of this was the availability of community testing. For people to sort of have that psychological guarantee, if you will, that they were either negative or positive, and understand that so we could appropriately quarantine would have been helpful. But, you know, generally speaking, especially when you look at the ongoing response from CDC, from FEMA, from HHS and others, there has been a very well coordinated response, much better than many other places that I've seen in the globe. So I think all in all, I give it a very positive thumbs up, but there's a lot of opportunities for us all to learn. And I think one of the biggest outcomes that hopefully will come from this situation is the widespread availability of PPE here in the United States, so that we're not relying upon other countries, especially countries that, you know, essentially had the origin of the outbreak. I think that's created a lot of supply chain issues for healthcare leaders and executives, as well as providers. And as a healthcare provider myself that's taking care of COVID patients, you know, having PPE is one of the most critical things that I could have for my protection. But we also have to have the appropriate training as well.
And what about this issue of there's this broad debate? On one hand, it's close the country down as much as possible, 100%. On the other hand, it's on the far other side is keep business going as much as possible, just sort of close in the elderly as much as possible. And then there's someplace in the middle, which is, you know, what's the balance between the economy and safety of COVID-19? What are some of your thoughts on that? I know it's become almost like a issue. You can't even talk about this concept of, is there any balance? You know, on one hand, some say the economy is so important. On the other hand, people say just safety is so important. How do you balance these out? How do you think about those things?
Well, I mean, I think anytime we take public health action that's broad, such as locking down the country, there is a fairly significant socioeconomic impact to our economy. And that's something that we should be aware of. That being said, if we have documented ongoing community transmission, especially in settings like residential settings, long-term care settings, where we have residents, these are people that are going to be very vulnerable due to other comorbidities, then there might be something, as you mentioned, that's sort of a place in between, a sweet spot, if you will, where we can focus our efforts on those vulnerable populations like our elderly, those with comorbidities, immunocompromised persons, people that are, you know, receiving oncology treatment, and sort of find that sweet spot, like I said, where we can really not do a full shelter in place, but realistically make sure we can keep people safe. I think one of the big challenges that I've noticed with this particular pandemic is that most people have never experienced anything like this in their lifetime, and hopefully they never will again. But when you don't follow public health recommendations and you continue to have your normal daily activities, that creates a problem because we can't stop the cycle, as the government refers to flattening the curve. And this is being seen in some communities. And so we could also do some focused efforts in areas that are hotspots, like New York City is an example, where it might make complete sense to have a shelter in place order there because we have such significant community transmission. But for most communities, we can look at that localized data, make good evidence-based decisions about what we're seeing in that jurisdiction, rather than just sort of, you know, paint a broad brush and make the same determination for every community when each community might be experiencing different types of, patterns, if you will, with this particular pandemic.
Let me ask you another question. You've got people that have obviously become so reliant and so in need of just the regular healthcare services of all types, a very broad variety of them, from mental health to dental to knee procedures to a colonoscopy to just seeing your primary care physician for a checkup. Can a patient receive the regular healthcare services right now, and how do you judge that?
You know, if you look at CDC recommendations, there's been sort of a broad recommendation about canceling elective procedures if we can. And part of that was to sort of preserve the healthcare supply chain of PPE. And the other part was to protect both the providers and the patients that would be delivering that care. Now, let's take sort of two different extremes. One could be an oncology patient that's receiving regular chemotherapy in an outpatient setting. We must make accommodations for those patients to continue to receive that therapy, which is very, very different than a patient that's coming in for an elective colonoscopy that's being done every 5 years, as an example. And those patients can be rescheduled, but we can really dedicate the limited healthcare resources we have right now to patients that truly need that more emergent care. I think another example is urgent care facilities. I've seen here in the greater Atlanta area where I live, some urgent cares have just shut down because they just simply did not have COVID testing. They were worried about it. And in reality, you know, when we have pandemics like this, yes, we're going to see similar symptoms to the ongoing pandemic because people are concerned, but we'll also not see a decrease normally in the regular medical ailments that drive people to those practice settings. And so, you know, we want to make sure we're judicious about the use of our PPE. We want to ensure that we have the healthcare workers in the facilities to care for those patients. But we also need to look at the urgency of certain situations that patients might be going through. If they're going in for some type of TPN feeding, if they're an oncology patient, if they need an infusion of Remicade for arthritis or something like that, these are patients that we need to strategically prioritize.
A different question. This is a year that's been a bad flu season, not a horrible flu season, but in some places it's been quite bad. They talk about here, like the prison population has been one of the worst flu seasons in years. How do you overlay the flu season with this pandemic? How do those things work together, and how do you think about those things?
Well, there's been sort of broad correlations between seasonal influenza and the COVID pandemic, and I think we have to be somewhat cautious about that because while they have similar transmission, we hope that this does not become something seasonal with COVID, but we also have seen sort of a genetic predisposition for the virus to not mutate a ton. Essentially, its skeleton stays the same, which is promising for the development of a vaccine. But it is something that, and Dr. Fauci from the National Institutes for Health has done an excellent job of talking about, there may be another wave of this taking place. So in reality, we need to use this as an opportunity to strengthen our resources, strengthen our preparedness, and more importantly, make sure we have the right competent frontline providers that are able to care for this and any other novel respiratory disease, because I think from my perspective, one of the biggest lessons learned every time we have an outbreak or a pandemic is how do we use that information and that learning to prepare for the next one? Because it could be any organism, but as long as I know that route of transmission, I can stop its transmission. I can use the appropriate PPE. I can cohort my patients. But I think it would be a little bit irresponsible for us to sort of generally compare flu to this because the infectivity is different. This is much more contagious. It certainly is being sort of non-discriminatory in who it attacks. We've seen very healthy people as well as those that are very, very sick with other health conditions. So it is something we need to think about. But, you know, frankly, flu, we don't spend enough time on and people don't take it near as seriously. And I'm hoping that this will be a wake-up call for us to focus on good infection control practices like washing our hands, staying home if we're sick from work, those types of things.
In the long-term implications, COVID-19 is going to have some dramatic long-term implications in society, economically, healthcare-wise, otherwise. What are some of your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I'm not an economist, but I think there will be long-term implications on the economy. And it's up to us as, you know, consumers of healthcare and consumers of the economy to make sure that we are prepared for what might be coming next. And one of the long-term implications to healthcare workers is sort of a decreased resiliency. When we see healthcare workers that are this stressed, this constantly for long periods of time, like we did with Ebola, especially those that are having to wear personal protective equipment, this can cause an issue emotionally, spiritually, physically, mentally, all of the above. And so we need to make sure we rebalance that equation, re-energize our healthcare professionals, and make sure that they have confidence in our public health response so that when this happens in the future with some other organism, we do have the PPE, we do have the resources, we do have the community-based testing, and it's done rapidly. Because one of the things that I've noticed is that healthcare workers have really lost confidence in maybe their healthcare institution, maybe their healthcare leadership, maybe the federal government or the state resources. And so we need to make sure we recapture that confidence by preparing strategically for what might be coming next.
And you're already dealing with a situation twofold, shortages of providers throughout the country and in heightened burnout of providers across the country. And if you add this on, you really do have to figure out that way to restore trust and excitement and enthusiasm for being a healthcare provider, though this does imbue people with a sense of purpose that many have never had before.
Definitely, definitely. And I think part of that responsibility falls square on the heads of healthcare executives and leaders to simply say thank you to our healthcare teams. Our patients need to say thank you to their healthcare providers. When we see public safety out and about in our communities, we need to say thank you, because this has not just been a healthcare response, but this has been the individuals that report to our grocery stores, that deliver our packages, that maintain our food supply. And so it's really been what I think in my lifetime is a pretty unique observation of everybody coming together. Tesla, GM, 3M, lots of different companies are shifting gears to respond to this. And I think it really brings out the very best in the American economy as well as the American society to see this. And we've got a ways to go, but we can move forward, and we can move forward in a positive fashion, taking the learnings forward and making sure we're prepared for the future.
And another question, and I'll let you go in a couple minutes. We've got a couple more questions for you. Is there anything special that should be done for long-term care facilities to sort of prevent transmission and to keep them safe?
So, you know, long-term care facilities are most vulnerable, because these are people that are older, that have lived an amazing life, and we want to make sure they continue to live an amazing life, but they typically have multiple health challenges and may be on multiple medications. And so we need to balance the medicine with the humanity aspect. And what I mean by that is we want to restrict visitors that are going to come in. Most facilities have completely shut down visitors, which has a negative psychological effect. If I can't see my loved one, that can be very difficult psychologically for these patients. And so we want to have a careful balance of good screening. We want to absolutely ensure we're not putting these patients together. So we don't want to have mass congregations of people in activity rooms or anything like that. We need to screen our healthcare staff, check those temperatures every day, do a healthcare screening, check the residents' temperatures every day. But we also want to balance the equation of making sure they can still be connected to their outside life. And so I've seen some amazing resources, such as taking a relative on FaceTime into the room and letting them talk to them. Just this past week, I saw a gentleman who was singing through a window to his wife, just to let her know that he was still there. So while we're in a very difficult position in long-term care, we can absolutely make some changes to bring the humanity back in there. But this is a population that we must be very, very careful with. We must ensure that we're appropriately using PPE, that we're washing our hands, that we're staying home if we're sick. And this really requires a comprehensive approach to infection prevention to protect these very, very important folks in our lives.
Thank you, and fantastic. And then finally, Dr. Garrett, what do we do if we run out of PPE, personal protective equipment? What do we do if that happens?
You know, that's a very tough question. When we look back at what we learned from Ebola, no one ran into the room if they didn't have PPE on if the patient needed something, because pandemics are not medical emergencies. They don't require us to sacrifice our own personal safety to respond to that medical issue. And so it's important that, A, we have the appropriate PPE, B, we need to make sure that we're properly trained and competent to use it, and more importantly, we also need to ensure that we're removing it correctly as well. So in situations where the most appropriate PPE is not available, so for example, an N95 respirator is nowhere to be found, is it acceptable to use a surgical mask if that's all you have? And the answer is yes. It's not ideal, but nothing that we're dealing with right now is ideal. And so CDC has put out some pretty clear-cut and comprehensive guidance on what to do for each type of PPE piece. So gowns, gloves, mask, eye protection, those types of things, with suggestions. And I think one of the most impressive things that I've seen from this is the rapid response of the FDA to sort of open up the door to say, here's other masks that are available on the commercial market, not normally sold for healthcare use, that would be appropriate. And the same is being done for gowns and things like that. So it's really a matter of going back to good standard precautions, good hand washing, limiting the number of healthcare workers that are going to interact with these patients. And when in doubt, if you don't have any PPE, it's not safe to go in. And so we might need to look at allocation of resources so that we have dedicated teams that are caring for these people that have reusable PPE, like goggles that can be disinfected, those types of things. And that's the reality that we're in today. And again, most people have never experienced this in their career, so we're in uncharted territories, but there is guidance available on the CDC website to help us strategically sort of go through, okay, worst case, middle case, and best case. And it's important that they healthcare providers work with their local health authorities also to secure additional PPE through the strategic national stockpile.
Thank you very, very much, Dr. Garrett. Dr. Garrett, if people want to learn more about you or interact with you, how do they find out more about you or reach you?
Sure. So you can go to my website, which is hudsongarrett.com. That's two R's, two T's. Or you can certainly email me at hudson@hudsongarrett.com.
Dr. Garrett, thank you so much for joining us today. Just crazily informative, and we appreciate it so much. Thank you, sir. Thank you, doctor.
Thank you.